Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Finally, sunscreen worthy of your skin. Sol de Janeiro's new Rio Radiance SPF 50 collection, where glowing hydration meets sun protection in a beachy and nostalgic set. Confidently embrace your glow with lightweight 100% mineral SPF body lotion, refreshing SPF body spray, and shimmering SPF body oil. Receive 10% off on your first order on soldejaneiro.com, plus free shipping with the code SPOTIFY10.
Hi, I'm Mari Forth.
And I'm Sarah Carradine. And this is Crime Scene, the True Crime Review podcast, where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told.
We'll put documentary features, short series, and long-running episodic shows under the magnifying glass and examine what true crime stories can tell us about ourselves.
We'll have fascinating guests each week to discuss our true crime passions with new and recent releases, as well as classics.
We'll give you our recommendations and suggestions for more viewing, listening, and reading on the side.
Let's open today's file. We watched A Crime to Remember, Season 2, Episode 2, Shot Doctor.
All right. This week, we have a great guest. We have a post-show recaps mainstay. She reviews all of the Marvel properties. We're talking WandaVision. We're talking Loki. Also, Star Wars properties. Hello, Book of Boba Fett. What's up, Mandalorian? And of course, she's my sister from another mister because we co-hosted the Insecure final season together. Miss LaTanya Starks. LaTanya, how's it going?
Hey, Mari, Sarah, thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here to talk some true crime for the first time ever on RHAP.
Yeah,
yes, this is exactly. Monumentous.
Yes, yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're here. We are talking true crime. And of course, we want to know what draws you to true crime? Why is it popular to you? Why do you watch?
I have loved true crime in some respects since I was a kid. I think it was because growing up, I heard stories all of the time about crimes that would occur with my grandmother specifically. My grandma and my mom are both from Mississippi, and they lived right in front of the Tallahatchie River, which is famously known as the river where Emmett Till's body was removed. Mm-hmm. They had several family members who were lynched or had other harm brought upon them. We have members of our family in Parchman Prison to this day. So, you know, it's almost a pedigree of true crime. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, and Mari, I'm sure you'll understand this, there's a history of oral storytelling in the Black community. Yes. Largely because, you know, in times of slavery, we weren't allowed to know how to write, and many of us could not write. So stories were passed down, and that still continues to this day. You know, even though we are, thank God, allowed to be literate, the history of oral storytelling still has not gone anywhere. And I feel like I learned so much about my family through true crime. But also I just was when I was young, wanted to be a forensic pathologist. So, my mom, who was a nurse, and I would watch autopsies by Dr. Bodden, on HBO, which is a totally normal thing for a child to do with their mother. It is a perfect mother-daughter activity that normal people do. Yeah. And so, yeah, I strayed away from that path eventually, but that didn't leave me from being completely obsessed with serial killers to this day. You know, from being from Chicago, we've got John Wayne Gacy. We've got Ed Gein in downstate Illinois. To name just a few, there are still tons of serial killers out there that are active, and several of them in Chicago. So, yeah, I've just loved true crime in one way or another since I was very young, and have never really had the opportunity to talk about it outside of friendship circles before.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. Do you want to talk about, don't you have a law background as well?
Yeah, I do. So I, after graduating from college, went to law school at Chicago Kent. And while I was there, my main focus was shaping up to be defense and criminal defense at that. So I there are clinics that are available at Kent where you can submit a writing sample. They look at your grades and, you know, they determine which of the clinics you should be in. You can rank your preference, and then they just decide based on a combination of your rankings and what they think your writing sample shows where you should be. And so I got to be in the criminal defense clinic, which was the top clinic in the school. It was very exciting. I was really happy about that one. And so one of the things that you do when you're in the criminal defense clinic is you assist in the what was it called? You assist. It's still called a clinic. You assist in the legal clinic, and that clinic is handling actual cases. So the professors who are on board at Northwestern are also, Kent are also representing people for various cases. So my first caseload that I ever got assigned, I think it was 10, 12 cases. And they were very, very severe felony charges. It was murder, attempted murder, rape, armed robbery, home invasion. Just like the list went on and on. And, you know, you have to go visit those clients then in downstate, in prison. I unfortunately ended up getting ill. Story of my life. And in my 2L year, halfway through my second year, I had to leave law school. But I loved it. I loved being there. And I loved the opportunity to get to learn, and was very happy that they had faith in me. They were already talking about getting me to take the test at the end of my 2L year so I could have what's called gone in front of the bar, which is essentially that I would have been able to practice as a law student under the supervisor of a licensed attorney. And so I would have been able to get a jump start on that just all from being in the criminal defense clinic, and because they thought that I could write briefs well.
That's amazing to hear. And I'm so glad to hear that, because, you know, we've talked a lot, but we rarely ever get to talk about our backgrounds. I've talked about it on Pod Friends and other episodes about how I too got a master's degree in like forensic science and went the forensic science, tried to go the forensic science route. But ended up in like corporate America because it's just easier. it's easier to land there more than anything. Sarah, I know you have a theater background, but what do you think about LaTanya's? I mean, that's a great background to have to be here and talk about, especially what we're talking about today.
Oh, absolutely incredible. The fact that you have had hands-on experience with these cases and you see how they work their way through the justice system. I mean, that's something that we're going to be seeing again and again in the series about not only how each property centers the victim or doesn't, but also how it portrays the justice system. I mean, my brush with that is being on a jury, a very horrible crime about 10 years ago while my father was dying. Mm. So actually, sorry, 20 years ago. Time stands still. Yeah. Yes, I was on a three-week jury trial, and it was a very difficult time for all of us. And in fact, about 10 years later, I met one of my fellow jurors in a tiny town in Tuscany. And we both immediately talked about how difficult that it had been for us. I mean, poor us sitting on the jury, right?
No, it's very hard to be on a jury.
Yeah, but we weren't the victims and we weren't the perpetrators. But yes, Latonya, that's incredibly impressive. Was there a reason that you didn't take that step to do the test so that you could practice as a law student?
Well, it was just a matter of
health.
I would have had to wait a certain amount of months because you have to be going into your third year in order to do that. And so I ended up getting sick before that time would have allowed me to do so.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. But I was really interested in things like voir dire and jury selection. I thought if the criminal defense thing didn't work out for me, I wanted to become a consultant for a jury consultant, which is essentially, the people that are hired, I'm sure you know, but just for the audience, people who are hired typically in bigger cases, it can be in criminal cases, but a lot of times it's in corporate law. And you are hired essentially to take a look at all of the people who are in the potential jury pool and then signal to the attorney whether or not they should use one of their peremptory challenges to stop this juror from getting onto the jury or whether or not the juror will be good for us, our side, and we should let them on and have no challenge to it.
Yeah, that's why I have not been on a jury yet. Every time I'm like scheduled to do it, the week I'm scheduled to do it, nothing happens. Like there's like no cases. So yeah, I never get on. And then I'm like, even if I manage to get to that point, I can't imagine I would actually be let onto a jury just because I'd be like, master's in forensic science. I'd be like, I have a true crime podcast. It's the worst nightmare.
They really don't want, our professors always used to say to us, if you want to get out of doing jury duty, just tell them you're in law school because they don't want anyone who might want to bring their own legal expertise into a jury room. They want to have it as untainted as possible.
Yeah. I always say to people, like people are famously here, and I believe in your beautiful country, how to get out of jury duty becomes the conversation. And I say, look, I'm not a goody two-shoes. I look like one, but I'm not one. But I do think it is a civic duty, and if we want to have a fair justice system, then we have a responsibility to be on the jury. If I, God forbid, ever go before a jury, I would like, to have people who want to be there. It's simultaneously the most fascinating and the most boring 3 weeks of my life. Right. I have tales to tell, but the interesting thing for me was the actual selection was pretty rote. We shuffled through, we had numbers, we shuffled through here, we shuffled through there, dropping off as we went. And finally, 12 numbers were called and my number was second. So we filed into the box and one by one, we had to stand up. And when we stood up, silk and the crown, the silk is the very expensive barrister for the defense, and Mr. Crown, in this case it was a man, Mr. Crown is the Crown prosecutor, in other words, representing the state. They could say challenge or not. The only person they challenged, this was so interesting to me, because we ended up 10 women and 2 men, all white apart from one young Muslim girl. The woman to my right was a middle-aged white woman, as I was myself. And then she stood up, no problem. I stood up, no problem. The middle-aged white woman to my left stood up, and they both said challenge. And to this day, I have no idea why they didn't know my name. There was no questioning. We hadn't even said a word, and they didn't know our identities. There was no questioning of us or our beliefs or anything, but both of them said challenge. And the judge just very kindly said to her, "You're excused." I think she was a bit annoyed. I think she was. Maybe she looked a bit too eager Maybe she was making strangling motions with her hands. I don't know. But and then everybody else stood up and sat down with no problem at all. So
I'm just saying, I would love to. I would love to serve on a jury. I truly would. I would want to see if somebody would let me.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh, every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love, and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
But all of this is very relevant. This conversation is very relevant to the property that we are talking about today. So, LaTanya, can you tell us what show you made us watch? Like, I don't want to say you made us watch, but we love to ask our guests to do a recommendation, and then we watch and we talk about it. So what moved you this week?
Well, following in the footsteps of a potential old client of mine, I got a gun and invaded your home, and I turned you on to investigation discovery, and I made you watch.
There's no need for that.
I made you watch a little show called A Crime to Remember, which is by far one of my favorite properties, if not my favorite property on investigation discovery. And there are a lot of shows I like on there.
Yeah,
there have been a lot of like down times in my life because of illness where I couldn't do much, and investigation discovery was all I did. So, that's saying a lot that this is one of my favorites.
Essentially, I completely agree. When you said A Crime to Remember, I was like, that it in my favorites. ID Discovery or Paramount Plus. I have three shows that I'm like, I need as quick access to these as possible. Like, you know what I'm saying? They're my favorite. Everything else, I'll just kind of like scroll through it on a day and be like, I don't feel like this today. But it's like three that I'm like, nope. I feel like a Crime to Remember is what I want to watch today. And this is one. I love this show.
Yeah. It's such a great show. Essentially, the reason that hooked me, even from just the commercials before the show ever aired, I watched it from the outset. The first episode when it aired. And the reason for me is because I said, okay, they're going to combine a costume drama with a period piece with true crime. I'm in. And that's pretty much what this show is. It takes a majority of the crimes, if not all of them. Well, none of them are contemporary to our times. So they are all shows that are they're all crimes from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And the show is always from the perspective and narrated from the perspective of a character that's created for the show. So it's someone who is supposed to be placed into the center of the narrative. They can speak with firsthand knowledge of what it was like to be there in the midst of the fallout of all of the events that are occurring, but it's never told from the eyes of a real person. For example, it's just it's a character device that the producers make up for this. So, for example, the story that we're going to talk about today is told from the perspective of a woman who was a child at the time at which the event went on and she was a singer, like a 9-year-old singer at the Black church in Live Oak, Florida. So, yes. You know, it's that, for example. And so it's kind of a retrospective look on, you know, here is a crazy true crime thing that happened that I happen to be around for. And mm-hmm. here are the real details. So it's very much for me in terms of like why I picked the show. First of all, it's one of my favorites. Second of all, there are a lot of cases that are highlighted that I just didn't know about beforehand.
Yes.
I'm one of those people who loves true crime so much. I feel like I'm watching a rerun even when I'm watching something new.
Exactly. It always feels like it's you've seen this case and you've seen it a million different times. So when a show comes along that even if it's a case you have seen, but it shows you a case that you have seen, but from a different perspective, it's always like a rare gem.
It is to find.
Yeah. So I just want to ask Sarah, had you watched this property before?
No. And I'm very grateful for the gift of a crime to remember. It somehow slipped past my radar, I have to say. And certainly, Mari, you and I watched something with reenactments in it recently that, the reenactment actors were nicht so good. So I approached this somewhat cautiously, I can't recommend it highly enough. Oh, I'm previewing my magnifying glasses later in the show. But I thought that the way it was laid out, and I think that familiarity that you're talking about is the rhythms of true crime, and the rhythms of true crime property are similar. We learn about the crime, and then there's the investigation, and then a twist if there is one, and then either an ending, a resolution, or no resolution, which leaves you up in the air. Yeah. Here, the crime was not one that I knew, but it seemed so rooted in the time, not that it couldn't happen now, but it seemed so rooted in the time, and it was so beautifully restrained. The writing and the acting had a restraint to it. The music was quite agitated, but the not calmness, but
it is a sense of calm.
The plainness of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then you get little moments. I know we'll get to it, but there were two moments that stand out particularly for me. One was just a look at a door, and another one was a scene over a plate of chicken. And both of them coming out of that plain calmness really hit home, in as much as we can put ourselves in any of the shoes of any of the people. That this is your best chance at doing
so.
I feel a sense of calm though when I'm watching this show. This show for me feels like slipping into something nice and comfortable and getting warm under the covers and then letting my grandmother tell me a story. It's something to do with the color saturation. That really enhances it. It looks really like you're soft. Watching an old movie. Yeah, everything's soft and like light. It's lit very differently. There's no harsh lighting going on. And that's true not just of this episode, but of all the episodes. It's just the way that they shoot it is different than any other true crime I've ever seen. It feels like you're watching some kind of film noir.
The thing that struck me as well, and I'm really eager to see now many, many more in the series, was, I mean, there are certain actors who have very contemporary faces, and when you put them in a period piece, it just doesn't work. I won't name names, but it happens. It's not their fault. The casting here was extremely good. The figures, not just the clothes they were wearing, but the inhabitation of the figures was really well done. They were wearing clothes, not costumes. And at the end, when the two main characters' photographs come up, I mean, I thought, oh, there's an extraordinary likeness. And then I thought it wasn't so much the likeness, it was the inhabitation that the actors, all of them, had in the time and the period. And I wondered about the sort of the behind the scenes of how careful and respectful and holding space there was for all of the performers, the black and the white, to go into that period of segregation and to inhabit those attitudes of the time. I hope that they were well looked after. I imagine so, because the whole production seems so thoughtful and
And these are all really like glowing reviews, because reenactments, like for me, especially when it comes to true crime, reenactments can make or break how I enjoy a show. Right. Voiceovers can dictate how I enjoy a show. Like, I'm a huge Snap fan. There's a lot of people like I who like true crime that I can't imagine don't like Snapped.
Right.
But when they changed the narrator's voice, the woman's narrating a few years ago, it felt different to me. And I haven't been as like I used to be able to every Sunday Snapped, it'd be on all day. Yes. I have that on while I'm cleaning or something like that.
I stopped watching when they changed the woman.
Exactly. It just is. It's weird. You get so used to hearing and it's setting an ambiance, and I know I'm getting Snapped because I'm hearing this lady's voice. And then the minute they change to the other lady, it's nothing unpleasant about her voice. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a perfectly fine voice, but it just doesn't resonate it with me as like however many years that I've been watching Snapped, and I this other lady's voice is the iconic voice. So yeah, it's just this really all goes to show you that the setting, the reenactment, the approach, especially to these type of series, like these ID series, and how they approach individual crimes, how it can either pull the watcher in or alienate the watcher. So,
what did you think of the selection of the talking heads, the experts that come in?
Yes, these experts. So, yeah, I wanted to get a list of the experts, because these actually they rotate. Not all of the experts on this one would be found on another episode. It actually made me really want to know how they chose the experts, to be quite honest.
One of them wrote one a book about, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the exact thing. One woman wrote a book about, I can't remember the name of the book, but yeah, she wrote a book about the entire
Ruby silencing story. Silencing Ruby or something like that.
Yeah, it silencing, was like silencing Ruby. Ruby McCullough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, and then they had a professor as well who was there.
Yes.
Who knew the area well and could discuss it. And then I'm not sure what the older black gentleman's
he was like a city, like a not an alderman, but he was kind of like a he's from the city itself.
Okay.
And yeah, and he was like a community leader in the city.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a clinical psychologist.
That clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you sideways a little bit.
So the talking heads can be hit or miss. That's another thing for me that really makes or breaks a true crime show. So this is one, you're right, Mari, where they do alternate, they change for each episode who it is that they bring in to talk about things.
Yeah.
Because they want to bring in people with as much topic knowledge as possible. Sometimes they can be hit or miss, and they really can bring you right out of it. I feel like they don't do a bad job in this one. They lend some more color to the story. They lend a little bit of more factual basis to the story. Yes. And, you know, in the case of the older black man, he just really gives you like a very just like straight, as my grandmother would say, downright straightforward and upfront like discussion of like, you know, this was segregated Florida, like the Deep South. This is where, you know, slavery was king until it, you know, and cotton was king for a very long period of time. And now there are tobacco farms, and, you know, my family grew up sharecropping, and they can tell you, or, you
mine
know,
mine did too.
Yeah. It's not all that much removed from slavery. You know, people are still living on the land of the more wealthy family that owns that land. And they're living in shacks in the, in the back, being paid not nearly as much as they should be paid. because every time they would, my family would take cotton over to the like mill to get their money, they were already always told that the sacks were light. They were always told that they didn't make weight, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So those two, you know, and things have not changed that much. I don't know how much time either of you have spent in the Deep South, but having to visit family there is the bane of my existence.
Yeah.
Going to Mississippi is one of the, if you want to know what I'm like when I'm having a bad time, and let's go on a trip to Mississippi. It's just terrible.
That'll get it all out there, put it all out there on the table. Yeah. Huh?
Everybody still expects, white people still expect the yes, ma'am, no, ma'am from black people.
Yeah, definitely.
And when they don't get it, they look at you like there's something wrong with you. They ask you what you're doing there, girl. You know, it's still very similar. So that man was like, you stayed out of white folks' business. Like, yep. You just tried your best to, you know, it was segregated and black people stuck to their business and white people stuck to their business and no one really crossed streams. And it was for a purpose. I mean, and they have. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Keep going. No, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, I was just going to say really quickly, it's for a purpose that we'll get into later as we discuss the episode, but it's literally life or death.
Exactly. And that's why I wanted to say that this is a perfect place to start. So let's get into the episode itself. So the episode even starts off like, this is one of the most famous crimes you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. Like truly, one of those crimes that like kind of changed the fabric of some of the laws down there. And I didn't ever know about it until I watched this episode a few years ago. So, it starts off at, we're in 1952, Live Oak, Florida, and we get a segment here about segregation, about Jim Crow laws, which LaTanya just so expertly had talked about. And of course, this is a time where it's separate, but equal. And everybody knows that, you know, they say separate, but equal, but it was not equal, you know, back then. And the big setup is Dr. Leroy Adams. He's found dead in his office with gunshot wounds. Initially, they just thought it was to his back, but we learned that he's first shot in the front, in the chest, then three times in the back. But he's also holding a $100 bill in his hand. And he was a prominent member of the community. Like, he was one of those doctors who actually treated both, you know, at the time it was called colored people and white people in deeply segregated South. So he actually helped both. And he was also known as the shot doctor because he apparently introduced penicillin to that community. Like, he was one of the doctors who brought penicillin and like one of the first people to treat, illnesses that we take for granted today that are easily curable by penicillin. At that time, before penicillin showed up, like, kids could die from just stubbing their toe and getting the cut infected. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But the moment this man brings a penicillin, he can now heal you with a miracle shot. It's like life changing and life altering to the community around it. And it imbues him with a sense of empowerment. Sarah, what did you think about this opening here?
Well, I think the opening is great in that it really situates you immediately in the time and in the, you know, in case you need to be reminded. And the fact that it was 1952, so almost in my lifetime, that this kind of separation, segregation, and that a white doctor who treated both black people and white people was of note. They had separate entrances and separate waiting rooms and separate treating rooms or treatment rooms. But yes, I liked this is the plainness I'm talking about, the economy of this narration and the idea that the person telling us has personal knowledge and experience of this time, I think just immediately draws you in, situates you. You don't think, where am I? What's going on? You're right in there.
Yeah. Can I also add that I loved the fact that they showed the comparison and were able to contrast the difference between the Black community and the white community through, you know, everyone goes to church on Sunday, but it's two different churches. And at the Black church, they're singing Wade in the Water, which is for anybody who has ever gone to church, gone to a Black church, knows that's a famous song. It's an old Negro spiritual about, you know, baptism, and a song that I used to hear every Sunday at church.
Yeah.
Whereas at the white church, they're singing Amazing Grace. Mm-hmm. Now, I would hear Amazing Grace at church, too, but not every Sunday. Not that version of the song by any means. And Amazing Grace is also one of those songs, you know, at least for when I was growing up in my church, that was saved for one of two occasions. Someone who was visiting church really needed to bring the house down, and it was going to be a concert, or someone died. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Like one of two things. So, but yeah, just like comparing, like using those two songs, really mm-hmm. important. And also to point out just the, you know, the importance of water in these communities, especially given all of the ways in which bodies were disposed in those bodies of water.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And that is something we will definitely be getting into. And I agree. I love how they put us right. They tell it to you right then and right there up front. The differences of the time period, the ways in which the two separate communities try to remain separate. And just like we said, it just pulls you right in to where you're hooked. And then you come to the true crime. So. They said that there are three witnesses. These are all Black women. And the witnesses told the police that they saw another woman enter the doctor's office. She had a argument with the doctor, and she shot him. Apparently, they said that she was trying to pay a bill, which is why he had that $100 bill in his hand. Another witness, this was a white man who was like sitting in a car outside, he saw two children in the suspect's car, and he reported seeing the Black woman who shot the doctor. She had on the same clothes and all of that. He told the police about how she had kids in the back of the car and what she was wearing. And through his testimony, they were able to figure out it was Ruby McCollum. And the reason why I say through his testimony is because when they asked the three Black women who it were, they were like, oh, we don't know who it is.
Who could it be? And it was a small town, too. So, yes. You know, lies.
Lies, yes.
Lies to protect the people in the community.
They knew the color of her purse, her handbag they could recognize. But no, I've never seen that woman.
Never seen that lady.
Never seen her before.
However, Ruby is the richest Black woman in Live Oak. When they actually searched her house, she had $1,800 in her purse. And this was at a time where the annual salary in that area was $2,000. So like this lady is well known in this community. And this is kind of where we're off to the races, because during their search in this reenactment here, she shows them the gun, and she says, I don't know whether I did right or whether I did wrong. And the police take that as an admission of guilt, and they, you know, promptly arrest her. So, I mean, this is so funny, in especially like rewatching this. This is a true crime series where it's like, we're what, 5-10 minutes into the episode, the murder has happened. They've caught the suspect. So at this point, if you haven't seen the episode, you're kind of like, well, where else are we going here? And the rest that unfolds is just amazing. But before we get to that, anything stand out about just the crime, how the crime is presented in itself, and like the quick arrest? Anything?
Yeah, just for me, the idea that the police officers were like just made a beeline to this woman's house. Mm-hmm. And they're like that there could only be one person. You know, they come in and they just get to look around wherever right. they want, yeah. Including in someone's purse, which, you know, there's a lot going on there. And I was about to make a comment about like, you know, going into someone's personal belongings and whether or not that's part of a search, but there's mm-hmm. no warrant involved here. There's right. no rights really that have been afforded to any to this woman or any of the other Black people that would be involved in this story. And so your traditional sense of that's another thing about a crime to remember is you start to have the wheels turning a little bit if you're a true crime fan about all the different things that are, you know, that were put in place in order to stop these types of like, you know, violations maybe from the police from happening. But you have yeah. to remember, you know, this was a way different time. We see what the police do and get away with now. So imagine the ability with which they were able to act with impunity here. They did mention here the boy who sent a Christmas card.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that something you're going to talk about later?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Feel free to lead into it. They do. Oh, yeah. They do have an aside here. Yeah.
Yeah. They have an aside there. I did a little more research. This little boy was 15 years old. His name was Willie James Howard. Mm-hmm. And he was lynched for sending a Christmas card to a white girl. And the girl was the daughter of a state legislature. And the state legislature actually was the person who came for the boy personally and may have been the one to kill him. And as they said in the program, that all happened in front of this boy's father.
Wow.
So, yeah, just like her giving herself up and showing and producing the weapon for them. Because other than that, they probably would have had nothing. They didn't seem to be finding much of anything. And they couldn't even point out that she was still wearing the same dress that she was wearing, you know, was supposed to be wearing during the crime. So the idea that she would give herself up, knowing that in many cases, the people on the police force were part of the KKK, mm-hmm. And that, you know, this person that she is almost confessing to the murder of was incredibly well connected. And we can talk about that a lot more later as well. Just, you know, is a little bit baffling. You had to think that her conscience had to really be weighing on her there.
Yeah. Yeah. Sarah,
a couple of things that struck me, the program shows us without comment, a bare hand, just pulling the $100 note out of a bare policeman's hand, pulling the $100 note out of the dead doctor's hand. We see a shoe casually stepping in blood and no comment is made, but I really liked that was such a quick visual cue to us watching the disregard for what even if you're not law enforcement, you know, don't step in the blood, don't touch things, don't change yeah. things. They go to her house. As you say, she's not wearing the same dress. They just open her purse and find her money. I was puzzled by her giving up the gun when we get the story of the lynched boy. There's also a voiceover of the care that the police knew they would have to take with her, mm-hmm. lest the press in the north mm-hmm. Turn their eye onto this community and what might be found. Yeah. And so I wondered if her motivation was guilt, helplessness, protection of her children, perhaps,
yeah.
or, I mean, she's a smart, smart woman. She might have figured that she had enough, as we'll find out, enough on upstanding members of the community to protect her.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking exactly. of the media real quick, this was a fun aside that I read. The headline the next day in the local newspaper was Dr. Adams slain by Negress, which... Just,
of course.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So the talking head says they had to take good care of her first off, because of the journalism, like they didn't want any of the northern journalists or anybody poking their nose into that deep South soil. I think that's what one of the definitely the experts or whatever said. But also, we get into her backstory too. You know what I'm saying? And how that she becomes, you know, rich. But before that, I think you have to be also thinking. They bring up the Willie Howard lynching because if they just put her in a regular jail, that's what they said. It's just, it's over. It's, you know, it's over. It's more than likely she will end up dead the moment she hits that cell. So I appreciate that they didn't, they took care of her, but like even the little girl that the narrator who is made up said it was not out of the goodness of their heart. It was purely self-preservation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because Ruby's backstory, she grew up, she was like very smart from a regular, I think it was like a almost, I guess, what you would call a middle class family in a sense. I didn't get a sense that they were like poor or they had during the tobacco trade, I think something like that. Yeah. But anyway, she married Sam McCollum, who had the largest allotment of tobacco in the county. So he was rich and well off. But more importantly, he was they both matched each other on being what's the word? Starts with the A. They both were ambitious. Thank you. Because I'm just losing it right now.
It's okay.
They both were very, very ambitious, and they seemed to want to grow their business together. But that's not where their real money came from. Like, this was definitely one of those things where if you know, you know. So Sam was in the Bolita business, or most commonly called the numbers game. This is like a historically Black, like this can be often found in Black communities. It's essentially the Black lottery. What you do is you go to somebody's house or whoever's setting up the numbers game. You put money down on a certain number to come out, or a certain series of numbers to come out, like be drawn randomly out of a bag. It literally is like the Black lottery. And it is one of those pillars of early Black culture that was something that was so inherent in this time period that like the moment they brought it up, I was like, wow, like this happens.
Yeah.
And Ruby was just so good at bookkeeping. She was really smart, really astute. So she kept the books. And because of that, they amassed that they ran their small business together, but they amassed a small fortune. But of course, they are Black people, rich Black people in a county of segregation where at any moment there it could be ripped away from them. You know, at this point, like Black people's rights were at the whim of white people. So they had to pay law enforcement to look the other way. There's no other recourse. Because they had to give them a slice. If not, it could be taken away from them at any moment. LaTanya, what did you think about seeing the numbers show up?
Yeah, I was very surprised the first time I saw this episode that that's where that was going. Because first of all, I was happy to hear Jook Joints said on television, because that's something I've only ever heard my family talk about. But I thought that when they were going to say that they made their money, that they made it from that or from the farming, the tobacco farming that that Sam McCollum was doing. But when Belita showed up, I was like, what? Oh, my God. This is just a game that, you know, was so big in the South that even the mafia started to get a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not surprise me whatsoever that the cops were in on it, because it was something that was illegal. And, you know, you have to pay off the police and bribe them in order to get away with things like that. So, you know, just being, you know, I was struck by the complexity of the economic system in the South at that time.
At that time.
So at one point you've got tobacco farming propping things up, but propping up the economy. But you also have the Bolita business that's doing that. and you have the police who are in on it, who mm-hmm. have to help, like, who are happy to see this crime being committed because it means that they get a piece. And mm-hmm. round and round it goes, like, that's all capitalism. But I was really shocked when I found out that they were involved in this. But then felt proud for Ruby because she always wanted to accomplish something. She had big dreams. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Sam saw her for the person that she was and the person that they could and she could help them be together. Yeah. And she really had to have been smart and have a head on her shoulders in order to carry off this very taxing operation behind mm-hmm. the scenes.
Yeah, she has a ledger, we hear, of every bribe and who it went mm-hmm. to. So this is where she's a very dangerous woman to the white people because she mm-hmm. has, she literally has their number.
Yeah. Good point.
That's a good one.
And because of this, Sam is notified in the episode. We get it, like, Sam is in church and he's notified that his wife was killed for killing the doctor. And we get like a scene of him like running out, packing everything up, throwing money into suitcases, getting all three of his children and fleeing to Zuber, Florida, where he had a family. But mysteriously, he's supposed to meet with the police the next day, but mysteriously he died of a heart attack. Yeah. So a lot of the talking heads are kind of like, do we believe he died of a heart attack? He died of natural causes. We don't even know where he was when he died of the heart attack. Yeah. They didn't really say. They didn't reenact it or anything like that. They just said he was supposed to meet with law enforcement the next day, but he died of a heart attack. And then they also said it is true that he had a bad heart, but a lot of people were like, I don't believe it. And, right. I mean,
yeah,
it feels very
seems dubious.
Yeah.
I just simply don't believe it. So it's just my opinion.
He could have definitely, you know, not only been dangerous to all of the people there who were getting bribes, but he could have helped to corroborate some of what honestly could have been an open secret, at least in the white community, mm-hmm. in terms of what was going on with the good doctor and Ruby. And that would have made it all the more dangerous for, you know, not only the case that they are trying to mount against her, but for keeping this out of the Northern press, which is what they all want so badly.
Yeah, we hear it's a place of whispers, a place where there are things that are known and then there are things that are spoken of. They're two very different things. But here we do find out that this is how the doctor became involved in their lives, is mm-hmm. he offered himself as the go-between between Sam and Ruby and the white people in power. Mm-hmm. And that was his role, as we first hear, his role in their business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And this is the scene here, Sarah, where he's like eating fried chicken at their table. And it is just for a reenactment, it's very menacing.
Yes.
The acting here was really good. Like he's tearing the chicken up. The two, Ruby and Sam, just look very tense.
That chicken did look good, though.
It did look good. Look really good. And he was talking about, you know, I can help you guys. I can, you know, and in the words, it was great acting. Shout out to that actor. But like in the words, it's like he's saying, like, I can help you guys. We can grow the business together. But undertone wise, it's basically you don't have a choice. You know what I'm saying? There's no choice in this. This is not me offering you my services. This is me telling you I'm taking a piece, really.
Exactly.
Very mob mentality here.
Beautifully done. They're sitting there. They don't eat. They don't speak. They have chicken on their plates, but they don't eat. Mm-hmm. And he is elbows on the table. I mean, we see this actor is fantastic.
Yeah, he is.
The a disgustingly visceral way. He's eating with no manners, throwing aside the pieces of chicken, sucking on the bones. I mean, it's a bravura performance, and it gives you everything that you need to know, because we've heard he's a sainted doctor. He brought penicillin. He treated the black people and the white people. Mm-hmm. He's running for Congress. He's going to be this wonderful pillar of the community. And we see him in this lustful, greedy, disgusting display, and it's a fantastic performance. It really just gave you everything you needed to know about the relationship.
Basically, like he owned the place. Like he elbows on the table, like he owned the place.
In effect, that's what would go on to happen, really. And that just shows you how pernicious this all is. Just like the idea that a white man can own all that he surveils. If he wants something, then he can make it his. And it doesn't, and you don't have any rights. It's just everything about the Deep South at that time, or the world at that time, if we're being honest, and a lot of our times now, in a nutshell. It was just a really well done scene. And the other thing I like about this show, because sometimes the reenactments can take me out of the overall story. These don't, and they're staged so simply. But you know, they have immense weight to them.
Yeah. And they break it up. They do a great job of kind of breaking it up, like with the voiceovers, like they can be doing a reenactment where there's no sound because the voiceover is telling you what's going on. They can do a reenactment where the characters are speaking, and then they can break it up with the interviews with the experts and the talking heads. Like, they do a really good job of just make it. It doesn't make you feel like you're looking at a long form over dramatized show. It feels like it's segmented. It feels like everything has its place, and that it's there to evoke an emotion.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Add a berry blast off for your day with the new Berry Pebbles. A berry twist on a classic breakfast. Perfect for giving those growing minds a blast of creativity. With the new Berry Way to Pebbles. Yabba dabba do you with Berry Pebbles. Head to postpebblescereal.com to learn more. Yabba dabba do and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements. Copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
But this is how he funds his campaign. This is at the time of his death, he's a state senator elect. So he had no money. He had a old Southern name, a family lineage, but no money. And so he basically elbows his way into their racket in order to fund his campaign. And this is where we find out that Ruby has a miscarriage in jail. And this is kind of where it all breaks loose here, because she tells her lawyer, Relaford McGriff, that the baby that she is miscarrying at this time is the doctor's. Not only that, but her youngest child, her youngest daughter, was the doctor's as well. Yeah. So Relaford McGriff rightfully is like, okay, we need to get a white lawyer for this, because it'll be more well received. And so he brings in that lawyer. And then so we get the story of how Ruby is just essentially caught between a rock and a hard place. We hear about how her husband Sam ends up having an affair with a teacher. And he had basically become abusive to her. The man that she thought she married somebody who wanted her as a partner and, you know, saw her as an equal. but we get a scene of him basically berating her in front of his friends and then abusing her. And then after that, we get another very heavily weighted scene where all of the experts weigh in and we get a reenactment where Dr. Adams comes to Ruby's house one day. I don't know if it was to collect money or why he was there, but Ruby answers the door and she tells him Sam isn't in. And this is the moment where the reenactment actors are not talking. They are just staring at each other over a door. It's so kind of hard to explain because the acting is really good here. Maybe I'll pass it over to Sarah to because you're really good at explaining it. But we get this scene and then we get several of the experts weighing in on, was this an affair or was he forcing himself onto Ruby? So right. Sarah, can you just set the scene for us here?
This was like, for me, just a masterclass in what you can do wordlessly. She answers the door. She stands in the door. She doesn't ask him in. That's fine. Mm-hmm. She says, Sam isn't here. And he just looks at her. And mm-hmm. we see on her face, as women, we see, and men can see it as well, but it obviously hits us right where we live. We see her realizing why he's there. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't make a move. He just looks at her and the camera is on her face and the transparency of the moment that she figures it out and the understanding of her powerlessness. And this is an ambitious, smart, rich woman understanding in that moment that she has no agency. And it's just a little dropping of the shoulders and a glance to the ground, and we all feel it, and we know what's going to happen. I mean, the use of the word affair, I mean, it drives me mad when people talk about teachers having affairs with underage students. These right. are not affairs.
Exactly.
We've got to stop saying affairs in all these cases. I mean, here we can't say this is the decision of the reenactment actors and the writers that she wasn't willing, but we do hear that he would give her, you know, one shot makes you sleepy and one shot wakes you up. The idea is that it's heroin and cocaine that he's providing. This adds to the non-consensual, our idea of, you know, our knowledge of consent makes this totally non-consensual. You can't consent if you are impaired in any way by alcohol or drugs. PSA, right. Everybody, not possible.
Period.
So although this brings a modern idea of consent into the story, I mean, consent was always there or not there. It's like it's yeah. not, we haven't made it up.
Yeah.
This was a man in power and a woman, exactly. no matter how powerful and safe you feel in your ambition and your money, and your status as a married woman, which mm-hmm. at the time generally is supposed to protect you from the mm-hmm. advances of other men, just the mm-hmm. fact of having a ring. And there's many a woman that I know in my life who's worn a ring that didn't, you know, that came from their own drawer just mm-hmm. to avoid the advances of men. But here we see that none of that is going to protect her from this visceral, greedy, lustful, entitled man.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Latanya?
Yeah, it's just, it's very weighty, that scene.
Yeah.
Where he is at the house and just the mere callousness of saying, you know, in talking about the injections that he gives her, you need that sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, just what this woman's body has had to endure and the idea that she has no agency.
Mm-hmm.
She went from being a young woman to being with who she thought was her soulmate and the person that would love and respect her. And that turned out to be a bust. He turned out to just be a bum,
mm-hmm.
like a lot of the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And then getting mixed up with him in his business and her business that she helped to run. this man just comes out of nowhere and decides, I want that and I want you. And there's nothing that you can do about it.
Yeah.
And it's just horrifying. It's everyone's worst nightmare to have something like that happen. And the way that this actress is just so resolved to it, mm-hmm. that you get the idea that this has happened so many times mm-hmm. to her, that mm-hmm. she just feels like there's no way out.
Yeah. I also think they did a really great job of, like, that's all we truly see, in a sense, is we see that door scene, then her pensively, you know, him stepping beside her to come in to the house. And then, you know, and then that's it. Like, we don't see, they kind of leave it ambiguous. And the experts, all of the experts except for one, I had to rewind it because I was like, I know I did not just hear that. But one of the experts,
I think I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, the clinical psychologist, last name was Ellis, implies that it was unfair. She said something to the effect of that Ruby was a powerful woman. Ruby knew what she wants. I could see that she would want to be with the highest ranking person, and that she would deserve that. And I was like, I truly had to stop and rewind, like, and see who said that. They did not show that lady's face when she said it, and they didn't show her face till way later on, and I had to catch the name later on. I'm like, I don't know if that was just that they were like, we have to have both sides or something like that. Because
no, you don't have to have both
you don't.
Sides. We don't. Exactly. No, there's no.
Not in a rape. You don't have to have both sides. There's one side.
All of the other experts, including the Black woman there who was like the, LaTanya, you had correctly, she was a professor.
Professor.
Yeah, her and then the lady who wrote the book, Silence in Ruby, who was a white woman, mm-hmm. They all said this is a power dynamic sort of situation. Like, how can you consent when, you know, they don't even ask? You know what I'm saying? When this person has feel like they're entitled to you. And there's a really good quote at the end that wraps it up that I'll say. But like, it truly was really sad to see. And
how do you consent when you can't even fathom the question? You know,
mm-hmm.
like, how is that possible?
Right. And I didn't like that, you know, and Sarah said it, like, there's a history of romanticizing unconsensual like sex acts as affairs. You know, we grew up with the whole Thomas Jefferson, Sally
Hemings
of it all. Yeah, Hemings of it all. And it's just like, when there are power dynamics, this is especially what we've been talking about with the Me Too movement and stuff like that, when there are power dynamics at play, you know, consent has to be, like, really needs to be reviewed, you know. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very rough. But we spoke about the cocaine and the heroin, and he also, like, if she would not do what he wanted, he would send her to mental institution.
That's the other thing about this woman having no agency and her body not being her own. I mean, we see a little bit of that before we get to that part of the story with the miscarriage, and just the fact that that scene is blood curdling. She's crying out for help. I feel mm-hmm. like so much of this woman's life is her crying out for help, mm-hmm. and just no one hears her. And when mm-hmm. they do hear her, they ignore her because she's Black and she's a woman and she's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Mari.
No, I'm so okay.
Mad. That, like,
very, very annoying. Because I mean, it's right out of like the sex slavery playbook. Like, he got her hooked on drugs,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that she could not give consent. So that, you know, it's just disgusting, you know. And then if she doesn't listen to him, he throws her into those mental institutions. And then when she got pregnant again with the baby that she miscarried in jail, she told Adams that she wanted to terminate the pregnancy. And he said, you're not going to terminate any child of mine, which is weird because at this point he was kind of trying to distance himself because he was,
right.
You know, he had just won his Senate seat and all of that. So that doesn't even make any sense to me.
Possession. It's about possession.
Yeah.
The child was the child everything. Was his possession as well. Mm-hmm. I own everything. Yeah.
Exactly. And then when she confronted Sam, because this was wild too. I was like, this is a lot.
Yeah.
She got a bill from the doctor for a DNC, which is a pregnancy termination. And she's like, I didn't terminate my pregnancy. So yeah. She confronted Sam about the affair with the teacher. And he basically said, well, I know about you and the white man. You got your white man. And he said he threatened her that if she had the white man's baby, then he would kill her. So the doctor threatened her that if she terminates that baby, he would kill her. And then her husband threatens her that if she has the baby, then he would kill her. So she, in the program, she said she was between a gun and a gun. Like, it sucks. Like, what is she supposed to do here?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, Dr. Adams wrote like a really messed up message at the bottom of the bill, like, Sam, keep your woman away, out of my office or something like that. So, you know, she found the bill. She went to pay it. And she allegedly, I don't know, like murdered yeah. him. Yeah. So we get to the court. We get to the courthouse, and the reason why we talked a lot about juries here is because her jury consisted of 12 white men, some of whom were patients of the doctor. So I mean, like, yeah. Really, what chance did she have?
I here? Also read. Sorry to interrupt.
No,
you,
no, no.
I also, so two things. The first is the trial was covered by Zora Neale Hurston.
Yes, it was.
Which is just beyond cool. Wow. Like a yeah. cool fact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the second that I just read and was, I had to go back and make sure that I was like not that hallucinating. The judge was a pallbearer at Dr. Adams' funeral.
Oh my gosh. No, I didn't know that. They did not say that in the episode. There are a few. Yeah, I do have a few notes here where the episode did not elaborate on stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I did not know that as well.
Yeah, he was pallbearer at the funeral, and he opposed a gag order on Ruby.
Yes, he did,
prohibiting her from giving interviews, and the mm-hmm. press was barred from the courtroom.
Yeah, and she was like she would they would ask her a question, and then the prosecutor would say, what is, I don't, why am I doing this part? Latonya,
objection.
Objection.
So in the court,
yeah.
Ruby decided to take the stand mm-hmm. because, you know, essentially this was a case with actually pretty circumstantial evidence.
Right.
You can say that what she said was a confession, but it was so cryptic mm-hmm. that, you know, who knows? A jury of not these 12 people
yeah.
room for doubt. So when she took the stand, she was asked several questions that would have brought into light the fact that she had been raped and assaulted mm-hmm. for years and forced to bear a child and then threatened mm-hmm. With murder and or imprisonment in a mental health facility if she didn't bear him another. But the judge repeatedly shut down efforts by Frank Cannon, who was McCollum's lawyer, to ask for details about the violence. She mm-hmm. was allowed to describe how about in 1948, during an extended absence from her husband, she had in her home submitted to the doctor. She was allowed to state that her youngest child was his, yet 38 times, yeah. Frank Cannon attempted to proceed from this point. 38 times he attempted to create an opportunity for Ruby to tell her whole story and explain what her motives were. And 38 times the state objected. So yeah. the prosecutor objected, and 38 times the judge sustained those objections.
Yeah,
that was an excerpt from Zora Neale Hurston's writings
Oof.
on the just fire writing. on the trial. But yeah, yeah, so essentially any objection that is brought forth, typically you have to be able to object on certain grounds. You can't just say objection. That's one of the things the movies and the TV get wrong. You have to say something like objection relevance, beyond the scope, tends to be prejudicial. But the judge decided that anything that Ruby would have to say would automatically be prejudicial against Dr. Adams.
Yeah. Basically, it seemed like they were trying to keep his reputation, like they were trying to protect his reputation.
As opposed to have a murder trial.
Yeah. And this is what was called, effectively silencing Ruby on the stand. Like the show kind of made it seem like she couldn't testify to anything. Thank you, LaTanya, for saying they let her testify that there was a relationship. Like, it seems like they let her testify that there was a relationship. Like, they wanted it to be presented as a relationship,
right,
as opposed to rapings, beatings, and druggings.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anything else on this before? Well, let me get to the guilty verdict, and I'll ask Sarah what she thought about this trial here. She was found guilty and sentenced to the electric chair. In the episode, we had like the black observers of the trial audibly gasp. After she was found guilty, she actually waited 18 months. She was in prison before she was actually granted another trial. But before that second trial, they sentenced her to life in a mental institution because they found that her she was not fit to stand trial. And in the show, they made it seem like this might be this again might be a way to silence her and make sure that nothing like they didn't want the papers again to, if she got sentenced to death and it was carried out, that would cause more attention to it than just basically shutting her away, prescribing Thorazine to her and electric shock therapy.
Yeah.
What did you think about this, Sarah?
For all that we're saying, it's beautifully made and well done. It is it's a hard watch.
Exactly.
And if so for me, then by a magnitude for you, I imagine. Mm-hmm. I thought that very plain showing of the courtroom, the objections, Ruby standing silently, I thought was incredibly effective. And I read a review on IMDb where one of the talking heads, a white man who had written also a book about this case, said something like, I worked really hard to find the transcripts and she did speak. And I thought, Guy, it's more truthful to see her standing there not speaking. Mm-hmm. Is actually more truthful than the fact that she did answer some questions. Mm-hmm. Because this whole idea of silencing and this whole idea of whisper, it's not just Ruby, it's the whole town who knows but doesn't speak. And then it becomes the whole state, the whole half of the country, the whole country and onward to the world. I thought it was incredibly effective in such simplicity of having her stand calmly, hands folded, silent, tells us the truth of the matter more than the facts that she did in fact answer some questions. So I thought it was really well done. I liked the idea, I thought it was well expressed, the idea of sort of above her and around her are these discussions. Will she be electrocuted? Will we kill her? Will we sentence her to life in a mental institution? And that her agency is not hers, her body is not hers, herself is not hers. It was the dehumanization of this woman and by extension all the women and all the black women.
Yes, all the black
women. Women of color, and other women as well suffered to a lesser extent. All the marginalized people that structures of power can silence, can dampen, can remove. And in this, it seems a very contemporary story to me as well.
I have the closing words here that I thought were just really good in the show. It says, so where does that leave us? What does it mean to be the richest Black woman in town in a time when Black people were barely citizens? What does it mean to have power when that power can be taken away? And taken away in the blink of an eye. And what does it mean to defend yourself in a court of law if when you aren't allowed to speak? Like, and it's just not about Ruby Cullum. Like Sarah said, it's about all black women and things that marginalized people have gone through. So it was a very poignant ending to the episode. But we do get a little, they gave us a little bit of the typecast in the corner to let us know that she was released from the mental institution in 1974. Her attorney was able to get her released under the Baker Act because she was not considered a danger to herself or others. Her Black attorney, Relaford McGriff, became part of a team who worked to change Florida's Jim Crow practice of selecting all white juries. So at the time, Black people were still disenfranchised. And so they weren't able to be jurors because they weren't allowed to vote. You know, it was limited to voters. So he went on to help change the laws. And that's just, you know, really amazing. And this case has, you know, has had renewed attention in modern times, because they said, have you heard, LaTanya, I don't mean to put you on the spot. Have you heard the what it's called, Paramore Rights?
Rights of people who have been in a relationship with each other for a certain amount of time?
Yes, but they're saying like, yes, Paramore Rights, but also in conjunction when there's like a power dynamic, like sexual slavery or forced marriage, stuff like that. Yeah, it's made people reconsider.
Yeah. So the law on that is like very much in its infancy, mm-hmm. and one of those ever changing kinds of things. It's still things that you know how there's testimony that happens in order to get laws passed. It's mm-hmm. still one of those things where in different states there are like notice and comment periods essentially for testimony. I haven't done a ton of research about it, but I have heard about it. And it just is a really huge step forward mm-hmm. for so many people who, especially people who have had to try to defend themselves, which if this case was happening in this day and age, it would probably have more national attention, but just because of the internet. Mm-hmm. And therefore, something like that would come into play just as a defense at the very least, in terms of here are all of the things that this person has had to endure mm-hmm. under the yoke of X, Y, and Z or this person. And therefore, it should be mitigating circumstances taken into account to determine whether or not they are fully guilty or guilty at all of any crime that they may have committed in trying to remove themselves from the situation.
Exactly. And that's why they're saying it's been a very modern trope, because it's been applied to like sex trafficking, mm-hmm. kind of like it brings to mind the Centoya Brown. Yeah. So it's really is one of those cases that seem to have greatly affected that area and that time period, but they kind mm-hmm. of did their job and they did silence her, because, you know, we wouldn't have known of this case if it wasn't for this show, you know? So, heartbreaking. So let's get into, there are, if you are still a little interested in some more documentaries about this, there are a few other properties, three documentaries: The Other Side of Silence, The Curtain of Secrecy, and You Belong to Me, Sex, Race, and Murder in the South. All have references to the Ruby McCollum murder. So if you want any additional information, you can check those out. But You can find, you can stream A Crime to Remember on Discovery Plus and investigationdiscovery.com. Sarah, by any chance, do you know where you can find it in Australia?
It's not streaming that I could find. I paid $1.99 on YouTube to watch it, and cheap at 10 times the price. It's a fantastic property. And while it's a very difficult sit, it is, I would say, compulsory to watch it. That's what I'm going to say.
Yes. You can also buy it here in America on Apple TV and Amazon Prime. We can include some links in the show notes if needed. Sarah, on a scale of 0 to 5 magnifying glasses, would you recommend A Crime to Remember and also this episode in particular?
Well, yeah, it should be 1 to 5, but I think we need to have a 0 just in case.
No.
5. No, I mean, look, let's have a 0 up our sleeve, but I hope we don't ever have to torture our listeners with a 0 magnifying glass.
Right.
I'm going to say, look, I just thought this couldn't be faulted. The clinical psychologist aside, that was just her opinion. I'm going to give this episode 5 out of 5 magnifying glasses. I haven't seen anything else in A Crime to Remember, but if they are anything like this in quality, then definitely 4, because I'm sure there are some that fall slightly below this. But yes, 5 mm-hmm. magnifying glasses for Shock Doctor from me. What about you, LaTanya?
I would give it a 5 as well, just really because there are so many of our stories that no one knows about and they fall by the wayside. And so whenever there's a spotlight shown on a story that has as many, like, just not just true crime, but there's the idea of segregation, there's the idea of dehumanization, there's lynching, there's using drugs on people, there's abuses of power. There are just so many different intersections of thought that are available to explore when you learn more about this case. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that it was presented. I thought that the acting was one of the better A Crime to Remember acting performances from the ensemble. So I would give it a 5 out of 5, but I'm biased because I chose the episode.
Same. I've watched all, it's 5 seasons of A Crime to Remember. And 5 out of 5 for the series, 5 out of 5 for this episode. Let us know if you would want us to cover another A Crime to Remember episode. Just letting the listeners point that out, but this was great. I'm so glad we got to talk about specifically this case, specifically my favorite, LaTanya's favorite, and now Sarah's.
Converts all around.
Yeah, converts. Yeah, shows. And just before we get into our promos, any recommendations about similar properties or anything else you would recommend, LaTanya?
Let's see. So I definitely recommend checking out All of A Crime to Remember. There are some really standout episodes in that show.
Yes.
I'm going to go back and rewatch because it's been a while since I've seen, a lot of them, but one of them that people might find interesting is that, if you all heard of the bystander effect, there is an entire episode, based upon the case that made that coined that term in sociology. Mm-hmm. That's something. There's an episode there about the clock tower shooting that happened at Texas.
Texas. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was the University of Texas. I can't remember which one.
I truly cannot remember. You're probably right. University of Texas. It is. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so just all kinds of great cases like this. There's like the Pied Piper case. Another one of my guilty faves that I watch all the time on Investigation Discovery is Deadly Women.
Yes, me too.
Mari, we need to talk more about this. I'm a really big fan of that show. And that's one of the shows that has this woman named Candace, who's a very consistent talking head. Their talking heads are
Candace DeLong.
Candace DeLong. Right?
Yeah, yes. She's amazing. Yeah,
she's fantastic. And she has some of the quippiest one-liners that you will ever find in true crime. If you like that kind of thing. I recently just watched a show on Netflix called Worst Roommate Ever, which just came out as we're recording this. It came out yesterday, and it was wild. The episodes went by very quickly. So it's a series, but really a mini series. I think there are only 5 or 6 episodes. Yeah, the first episode in particular.
Daisy Fuentes.
Yes. Dorothea Fuentes.
Dorothea
Puente. Really took me on a ride. I did not expect it.
Really? You haven't heard that case before?
I hadn't heard that case before. Mm, and like I said, okay. I'm always excited when I find new true crime things. Mm-hmm. This is a different medium, but I don't know if you all listen to the You Must Remember This podcast. If you don't, you should. It's by Christina Longworth. She is prominent in the podcast circles. She talks all about just this, really started talking about actors, actresses, the studio system of yore starting in the 1920s. But she has this phenomenal, and I mean phenomenal, series of episodes on Charles Manson and the Manson family.
Oh, Manson, okay.
Yeah. And I thought that I was just like, I know everything I need to know about the Manson family. You know, if you're interested in serial killers, this is serial killer 101 kind of thing, even though he didn't technically kill anyone. But he did lead other people to do that. And that was more spree killing, I guess, than serial killing. Mm-hmm. But according to the technical definition, anyway, her series on A Crime to Remember is amazing. And you can actually find it on YouTube if you want to get all of the episodes just kind of like in a clump and not have as many commercials. Mm-hmm. She has really cool people doing reenactments of all the voices, and she goes in depth into kind of how not only Charles Manson's growing up, but how he tried to get himself into the music scene in LA, you know, and with Terry Melcher and people like that, and failed, and how he really took his revenge as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And then what is another, if you haven't seen the Paradise Lost series,
LaTanya, there's so much. We're writing it all down.
Yeah, this is the last. That's the last one I'll say.
Yes.
But if you haven't seen the Paradise Lost series, I would definitely recommend those movies as well.
I've seen those. Yes. Yeah. You're gonna have us knee deep in stuff to watch.
Yeah. I was like, I promise this will be the last one.
No problem. All right. So, LaTanya, just tell us where people can find you.
You can find me on Twitter at LK Starks, and I will be there talking about all kinds of things. I recently did a podcast for Post Show Recaps, guested on the Severance podcast, which is a new Apple TV Plus show. We finished up our Oscars podcasting yesterday with Grace and Ariel. I'm also doing a podcast on Pam and Tommy Lee, which is a TV show on Hulu. And then I have some secret projects.
Yeah.
Shh. you are fun. Coming up soon, that I want all of you to stay tuned so you can check out. You can also follow me on Instagram at Stormborn1222.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. As Mari says at Crime Scene, we really do want to hear your feedback. You can give us suggestions for future episodes. You can tell us what you think. You can tell us who your favorite serial killer is. Apparently people have favorite serial killers. So you can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP, and that's scene spelled S-E-E-N. You could email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com. You can follow me at Sarah Carradine on Twitter. And I'm currently doing a couple of recaps for post-show recaps, Bridgerton and Our Flag Means Death. And what about you, Mari?
Okay, so of course you can find me on the Wrestling Wrap Up podcast every week with Matt Scott GW, where we go over the highlights in wrestling for the week. And I meant to interrupt LaTanya. We can actually spoil that super secret project. Me and LaTanya.
Oh, we can?
Yes, we can.
I didn't think we could.
We can. Me, LaTanya, and Chappelle, if you are familiar with our Insecure, the final season of Insecure coverage, we are back to cover Atlanta for post-show recap. So hopefully you are listening to that. Or if not, I'm telling you now so you can go and listen to that right now. But we are covering season 3 of Atlanta. So come join us as we go on this weird, wacky European ride with Earn and the gang and have some, hopefully some funny and in-depth discussions about a very just in its own lane type of show.
Incredible. So much fun. Wait for that.
Yay. Yes, exactly. Next time on Crime Scene, we'll be reviewing Icarus, which is a feature-length documentary based on like a Russian doping scandal. So I'm very excited about that.
Oh, look, thanks so much to our sublime guest, LaTanya Starks. Thank you so much for coming and being on the podcast. It was wonderful.
Thank you both so much for having me here to talk about true crime. I am so just excited about this podcast and everything that you all are doing here. And I'm really happy to be a part of it.
Well, we'd love to have you back again.
Oh, I'll be back.
Yes, definitely. Yes, yeah. Please. Okay, great.
Thanks to Will. Oh, sorry.
I promise. I'll be
excellent. Thanks to Will from America for the theme music and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time,
case closed.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.